I want to just sort of make an observation, which I'm guessing is true, although I didn't walk around because I wanted to be in one of the groups, which is that if there's one thing you could learn from having this conversation, is that this conversation could take you to some very deep and involved and fundamentally altering places. So much so that I'm going to suggest that now that you spent 7 minutes writing and 10 minutes talking, that people consider in the next 3 days taking an hour and actually writing about this in a more sustained way, and also writing about this in light of things you heard some other people say. Because I think it's often very generative. It's like things that are so simple that it's hard to think of them. I know that's something that happened to me just in my group. So, okay. So, yeah. I'm not sure in that I haven't quite figured out the sort of like origins of that idiom. Sefer Panim Yafot, I think, sort of suggests something like the presentation of a positive face, but I don't know what additional word the word sefer is doing there. I think it's an interesting question. I've been thinking about the same thing. And I don't think it's a very common phrase in rabbinic literature. If you played on Bar Ilan, you would not find it, like, it's not pervasive. So it's not a good, I don't have a good answer other than to say, like, I have that question too, and I'm still thinking about it.
The phrase is in the dictionary as hospitality.
Yeah, no, right. The phrase is in the dictionary from this Mishnah. But it doesn't appear all over Chazal, for example. Yeah, it's interesting that it colloquially means hospitality, because I think it means something one step prior to hospitality. And the fact that it comes to mean that suggests that Shana's and Rachie's and different comments that people made are all kind of... Because, in other words, the question is, well, what's the consequence? And it sort of leads to this expansive definition, right? Because a smile with no consequence is not a smile. It's fake in some way. Okay, so there's just a couple of other things I wanted to put out about Tzelem Elohim. There's obviously a lot more to say. Two things. The truth is that those of you who were in the summer at Yeshivat Hadar have learned versions of this, but I want to just sort of reiterate it in this context, and those of you who haven't want to sort of introduce it here, is that in modern Jewish thought in particular, and those modern Jewish thinkers who emphasize this point will insist that always in Jewish thought, one of the consequences of taking the notion that the human being is a Tzelem Elohim seriously is the notion that the human being is called upon to be a creator like God, right? That Tzelem Elohim implies the capacity to create. This is a bridge category between whether this belongs in Tzelem Elohim or whether it belongs in V'halachta B'drachav, right? Whether it belongs in what it means to be a person or what it means to walk in God's ways. But the notion of being a creator, that is, or maybe put it in a slightly more philosophical idiom, right? Being Tzelem Elohim comes with the capacity for agency, right? The capacity to impact upon the world, to impact upon my life. I mentioned to someone in this group that I was talking to the other day that there's this one Christian theologian who writes a lot on religion and science questions named Philip Hefner, who defines the human being from a kind of theological perspective as the created co-creator, which if I were to render that into Hebrew, can do that even better than English in a way, sort of a yitzur yotzer, right? Creating creature. And, right, the sort of danger of theology, I suppose, is if you just focus on being created, or you just focus on being creator, you either end up being excessively into the you're nothing mode, and if you just end up as creator, you end up being A, arrogant, and B, self-deluding. You know, all you have to have is, like, you know, an immense and irrevocable tragedy to realize that there are limits to your agency in the world. Right? I mean, I say that. You can fill that in with literally, sadly, tragically, endless varieties of content. But this notion of being Tzelem Elohim is the capacity to be a creator. You know, the classic Jewish source, in a way, for that, although I still don't know that I really understand what that statement originally meant, right, is the Gemara that says that one who makes Kiddush on Friday night, parenthesis, thereby testifying to God as creator, Na'aseh shutafo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'maaseh b'reshit, right, becomes God's partner in the act of creation. The question is, you know, what that actually means. And of course, that notion of shutafut will become very important in all kinds of modern Jewish thinkers. And interestingly, for those of you for whom this is interesting, I think you find versions of this, right, very dramatically in Hermann Cohen, right, the great Jewish neo-Kantian. You find it in great Reform rabbi and theologian Leo Beck, and then you find it sort of made a, like, the centerpiece of his theology in Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, for whom the human being as creator becomes the kind of, I don't know, sort of fundamental category of how we understand Tzelem Elohim. And I talk about that a little bit for those who have not been here during the summer, during the introduction to the talk on Soloveitchik on Tefillah. And so that's one thing I just sort of want to sort of suggest, that sort of think about that the notion of agency is part and parcel of what it means to take the dignity of Tzelem Elohim seriously, and it's a kind of counterweight to the theology that says you should really just have an entirely passive form of bitachon, right? A passive form of trusting that God will do for you. And let me put in technical terms, it's a kind of rejection of quietism. Quietism, right, is the notion that basically, like, just sit there and God will provide. It's actually, right, an insistence on not just the permissibility, but the mandate for human agency in the world. And just to be clear about this, historically, Jewish sources have not been univocal or unanimous about this, right? There are plenty of voices in the Jewish tradition that talk precisely about quietism and passivity. Which is why, right, Rabbi Soloveitchik's insistence that this is the Torah view, man as creator of worlds, is in fact, despite his protestations to the contrary, not muvan meilav, not self-explanatory. Maybe a one-second philosophical digression, just so you know this and sort of can function in Jewish sources. There's a very interesting, how do I say this exactly? There's a very interesting linguistic, prevalent linguistic distinction, right, in Jewish philosophical sources. That is that you use the word yotzer can apply to humans and God, but bara applies only to God. You'll, as far as I'm aware, you'll never find a Jewish source that will apply the word bara to God. Now, either as a result of that or as a cause of that, that's often because bara is taken to mean ex nihilo. That is, God's creation of something out of nothing, which a human being can't do. So just so you know that, if you go looking in the Middle Ages for a source that talks about a human being as Bore, you simply will not find that. But as Yotzer, you might. The exception of one thing I'm thinking of, Midrash Tehillim, which is late, which I think says Mahu Bore Olamot. But as a rule, you will not, Avata, as a rule, you will not find that language. Certainly not after the medieval philosophers have introduced the idea. It's a funny way to say this. There are some places where I could get kicked out of for saying this. After the medieval philosophers have introduced the idea that Genesis 1 is talking about creation ex nihilo, then all the more so, no one will ever say bara about a human being. Because that is, by definition, something that God can only God can do. And at some point in Shana Vav at Yeshivat Hadar, we can have a discussion about what the term creation ex nihilo actually means. Creation out of what we usually render as creation out of nothing. If you have no idea what I'm talking about right now, great, that's fine. It's not that important. Creation ex nihilo is yesh mi'ayin. Okay? Okay. Now, the second piece beyond creation, the second piece that I wanted to just point your attention to is something that becomes very important in 20th century thought, and that is the notion of shlichut, right? The notion of having a distinct purpose that God has in mind for every human being. This is particularly important, again, in Rabbi Soloveitchik, although the influence of Rabbi Soloveitchik here is Rav Kook, for whom what it means to believe that I am brought into the world is to believe that God has a purpose for me. And what I will put out there as a question to think about that we won't discuss now for the simple fact that we don't have time, but I want to just sort of mention it, is to what extent does one have to believe this as a metaphysical truth in order to internalize this as a kind of I'm going to orient my life around that commitment truth? I could imagine someone saying, well, what do you mean? How could you have the latter without the former? I could imagine someone saying, no, well, how would I even know? You know, that's a kind of metaphysical truth I don't have access to. But do people understand the question I just asked? I mean, to what extent do you have to believe that it's literally true, right? God created me with my distinct purpose, right? To what extent do I have to believe that in some almost literal way in order to believe as an orienting idea there's a distinct purpose I have? Rav Kook and Rav Soloveitchik, I think, believed it quite... You know, they believed what they were saying. Right? You should not, by the way, read into my question the assumption that I think it's not believable. You should simply sort of take it as, I think it's an interesting question to think about in general. Now, just maybe as a way of keeping this in mind, since we're running out of time, I will suggest that people spend a few minutes on this in Chavruta if you've never learned it, and actually for that matter, even if you have, is Rav Kook's incredible inversion of the language of the Sidur. I mean, he would not call it an inversion, he would call it an explanation, right? We say on Yom Kippur, the Gemara describes it as the prayer of one of the Amoraim, but we say it on Yom Kippur. At the end of the Amidah on Yom Kippur, all five times, we say, Elohai ad shelo notzarti eini chidai. Before I was created, I was of no worth. Ve'achshav shenotzarti ki'ilu lo notzarti. And now that I was created, it is as if I was not created. And if you keep going, you realize what, of course, that means. Because it continues with, Afarani v'chayai, right? Etc. I am nothing. I was nothing then, and I'm nothing now. Right? Afarani b'chayai kal v'chomer b'mitati. Right? Says Rav Kook, I'm just going to read this very quickly, translated, and We can meditate upon it basically for the rest of our lives if you're open to it. Elohai, Achol Anotzarti Eini Chidai, says Rav Kook. V'achshav Shenotzarti Kilo Anotzarti. Right? Lifnei Shenotzarti, before I was created, Kol Oto Hazman Habilti Mugbal Shemeolam Ad Shenotzarti, in that whole limitless time, from the beginning until my creation, Vadai Lo Haya Davar Ba'olam Shaya Tzarichli. Clearly, there was nothing in the world that had need of me. Ki im hayiti chaser bishvil ezo tachlit v'hashlama hayiti notzar. Right? The fact that I was not created until now means that in the past I wasn't needed, because had I been needed, I would have been created. Right? This is a kind of robust theory of sort of divine providence and the management of souls in the world. V'cheivan shelo notzarti ad oto hazman hu ot. Right? But since I was not created until the time that I was created, that is a sign. Shelo hayiti kidai ad az lehibarot. Now, I cannot tell you how much time, I would be embarrassed to tell you how much time I have spent in my life trying to figure out what would be the best way to translate how Rav Kook is using the word kidai here. Right? It sounds like a dumb question, but it's not a dumb question. Right? That shows that it was not worthy, or I was not worthy, or I was not needed to be created in that moment. V'lo haya bitzorech ki im le'et kazot shenivreti. I was only needed, there was only a purpose for me in this moment that I was created. Mipnei shehigia hasha'a she'ani tzarich lemalei eze davar l'hashlamat ha'metziut. Because the time has come, the hour has arrived, when I am needed to fulfill something that is not filled yet in creation. I am needed to perfect something in the world. Now comes Rav Kook's amazing inversion of the tefillah. So, Elohai Achol Anotzarti Eini Chidai. Right, that we understand now. Until I was created, it wouldn't have made sense to create me because I wasn't needed. Now comes Rav Kook and says, what does it mean? V'achshav shenotzarti ki'ilu lo notzarti. Now that I've been created, it's as if I weren't created. V'ilu hayiti miyached ma'asai el tachlit briyati, hineni achshav kidai. But if I directed my actions to my purpose, I would be worthy now. I would be kidai. Aval kevan she'ein ma'asai mechuvanim l'tov ha'tachlit, harei lo higati el tachlit briyati, v'eini adayin kidai. But because I do not direct myself and my actions to the purpose that needs me, I have not achieved the purpose of my having been created, and so I remain unworthy just like beforehand. So now, think about what we said. The prayer originally means, Achol Anotzarti Eini Chidai. Right? Until I was created, I was unworthy. Now that I've been created, I'm still a nothing. Comes Rav Kook and say, Elohai Achol Anotzarti Eini Chidai. Until I was created, there was no need of me, and so it wasn't worthwhile for me to be in the world. And you know what I'm here to do tshuva for on Yom Kippur? For the fact that even though I was created, which means there now is a purpose for me, I go on living as if there isn't. That's Rav Kook's inversion of the end of the Yom Kippur Amidah. Right? I go on living as if there's actually nothing that needs me. And so, I embody my own belief in my insignificance. And that makes me unworthy. That's essentially, you know, Rav Kook's argument is, right, what he does here in this kind of amazing commentary on the Machzor is to say, right, I am supposed to step up to the plate on Yom Kippur. By the way, I will just add, I think that is one of the two main reasons, for some this may be obvious and for some not, why we read the book of Jonah on Yom Kippur. It is not only because Jonah's story is a model about tshuva, it is also because all of us are Jonah. That is, asked to do something and instead asking if there's something else we could do instead or do nothing in particular. right? And so all of us are Jonah, and as Ne'ilah begins to approach, we actually sort of stop and remind ourselves, are you still running? You're still hiding? You're still sort of sleeping?
Yeah, directly to what you're saying, is this sort of implying that as humanity we have a purpose? Or is Ruffquick saying specifically each one of us?
You. Me.
And so there's a possibility, so it incorporates both not doing what you're supposed to be doing generally and also maybe fulfilling someone else's mission instead. Like you might be just getting it wrong.
Okay, so if we had a lot of time to think this through, we could play with it. I'm not sure that he would mean it quite so, sorry, you're in big trouble because I just took your mission and now you have no purpose in the world.
But
yes. I mean, in other words, the point is, let me say it this way, right? I think that Ruffquick's consequence here, the consequence of Ruffquick here, is that we have to ask, right, two questions. And if you have heard me say this at Kilat Hadar and other places, right, not just what can I give, but also what can I give? Right? Not just what can I give, but also what can I give? That's what he's trying to do here. How can I serve? Now, I'm just going to sort of suggest something that it's just that, it's a suggestion to think about. That on Yom Kippur we try and experiment, but only if you can really do the work to get there. Which is the first four amidot of Yom Kippur, Ma'ariv, Shacharit, Musaf, and Mincha. We say, Elohai, Achlo notzarti, Eini chidai, V'achshav shenotzarti, Ki'ilu lo notzarti. And then for Ne'ilah, we end the Amidah by saying, Elohai, Achlo notzarti, Eini chidai, V'achshav shenotzarti, Hine nishlacheni. Right? Until I was created, I was not worthy, but now that I've been created, here I am, send me. Which is actually taking, obviously, language from the prophet Isaiah, but actually taking Ruffquick seriously. V'achshav shenotzarti, hine nishlacheni. Now, I want to just end this section on Salam Elohim quickly by just looking at a source from Vayikra Rabbah that is, it appears in at least one other place that I want to just share with you. I'm skipping the piece from Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik has an essay. If you want to come to Yeshivat Hadar for a summer, we might even read it. The essay Shlichut, which is sort of a 35-page elaboration of, in some ways, commentary on Ruffquick's piece. But Vayikra Rabbah, I want to share this because almost every human being has some moments of feeling like, me? I am limited physically, limited emotionally, limited spiritually. Who am I to do something important? And this statement, I think, is one of the more arresting images in all of rabbinic literature. Amar Rabbi Alexandri, Hayadiyot hazeh im mishtamesh bichli shavur genai hulo. Rabbi Alexandri said, a regular old person, if he or she were to use a broken vessel, they would regard it as degrading. Aval HaKadosh Baruch Hu, kol klei tashmishav shvurin hen. But God only has broken vessels. This is an incredible image, right? You, again, always keep in mind with these images that compare God to people that the way Chazal turn it on its head, you might think human beings have no choice but to use fragile vessels, but God has perfect vessels. No, the argument here is human beings, a regular old person, right, regards using a broken vessel as degrading. But God's not interested in using anything else. Now, God has only that. Now, it took me years after I first learned this text to realize that this text is doing something unbelievably beautiful at another level beyond what he just said. And let's look at the proof text for a second. Dichtiv karov Hashem lenishberei lev, harofel lishvurei lev, There are three verses that are quoted. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted, the healer of shattered hearts, etc. I want to just suggest, right? In other words, the point here is, right? God, here's the surface, right? God is close to those who feel in some way broken, damaged, inhibited, limited, unable. But the use of especially the second two psukim, but probably all three. One, harofelu shurei lev. And two, lahachayot ruach shvalim, to enliven, is actually the suggestion that it is in serving that healing becomes possible. That's what it says. I mean, right? How is Rabbi Alexandre using this pasuk? Harofelu shurei lev. In the context of your vessel that God uses. The proof that your vessel that God uses is God heals broken people. The logic of that text, it seems to me, is the contention that there is something that is healing of one's inner world in the act of serving. Now, if we had a lot of time, we could have many conversations about how we have to make sure that serving comes from not a place of being, right, an abused shmata. Right? To be sure. But the notion that there's a rejection here of the notion that I can't give because I've been hurt. This Rami Alexandri, I think, is actually saying, you know what? Maybe bedafka you should give. Because that might be the most surefire way to heal. And, yeah. Okay, we'll leave it at that. There's a lot to say about that that text. So what I want to just sort of leave you with about that text is simply this, right? Which is, there is no contradiction between Tzelem Elohim and imperfection, inadequacy, or even self-doubt. This text confronts all of that head-on and says, you know what? That's who God wants. And that, I want to suggest, you know, here, you know, this is really the last thing I want to say before I leave the Tzelem Elohim topic behind. I think that's what it means to believe in the notion that the God of Israel enters into covenant with human beings, right? That is, that the amazing sort of mystery of the cosmos is that God dafka wants broken, fragile, inadequate, and you can fill in all of the words for whatever psychic shortcomings I might have. Just get me wound up. Jealous, petty, angry, combative. I think I might have to stop here. No, but I think and that's the claim. The claim is that God wants that, which is another way of saying God wants us, which is another way of saying that Judaism believes in covenant. Jana, would you like to say Kaddish Derabbanan?
Sure.
Sharkoff.
Thank you.